Hello and welcome to the Majlis, the Central Asia podcast at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. I'm Mohammed Tahir, director of the Turkmen Service at Radio Free Europe. Essay writing competitions are held among school and university students on how to best describe the president in his policies. Parliament awarded him with the title of the leader of the nation. He himself likes to be called Your Excellency President. An MP once called him the sun and the star of happiness. As the personality cult of the president is on the rise, opponents are jailed and independent media is increasingly squeezed. Welcome to Tajikistan. Today, we are planning to talk about the country and its populistic president who is increasingly taking the same path of the Turkmen leaders. What is causing to this change? What does it mean to its future? Are they early signs of new chaos? This is the topic for this edition of Majlis, the weekly Central Asia podcast. Okay, to discuss the subject, I have Edward Lemon, Tajikistan researcher at the University of Exeter, Steve Sertlu, Human Rights Watch researcher in Central Asia, Bruce Panier, editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Central Asia blog called Kishlak Uwazi. Welcome, gentlemen, to the Majlis.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
In most of the reports, including the ones, Steve, your organization publishes occasionally and annually, Turkmenistan is the country stays at the bottom of all of the indicators. Its leaders are described the worst dictators in any of internet, freedom of press and expression. Style of the government is authoritarian at best. But lately, we have a new competitor in Central Asia, and that is Tajikistan. Today, we are talking about increasing personality cult of the president in Tajikistan and what does it mean to the country and society at large. Let's begin with some of the recent signs of shifting political change in the country. What are some of the striking points, Edward? Let's start with you.
I think we're seeing two developments. I think on the one hand, last year we saw an unprecedented crackdown on the opposition. We saw the region's only faith-based legal opposition party, the Islamic Renaissance Party, banned, over 200 of its members arrested, and the organization declared a terrorist organization. So on the one hand, we have this kind of crackdown on freedom of speech, crackdown on the political opposition. Yeah. On the other hand, what we've seen late last year is proposed changes to the constitution that would declare President Rahmon, the leader of the nation, which would effectively lift him above the law, lift him and his family above the law, and allow him to rule the country indefinitely. Coupled with that, you have a change to the constitution allowing adults of 30 years and above to run for president, and that would allow his son, Rustam Emomali, to take over should he suffer any health problems after the next presidential election, which is scheduled for 2020. So you've got this kind of crackdown in the opposition on the one hand and a kind of strengthening of Rahmon's grip on power on the other hand.
Right. There are a number of signs, obviously, repression and, crackdown. We have also witnessed this similar stuff in Turkmenistan. There are several other similarities, like in Turkmenistan, the president's titles, books and poems written about him. Kids are taken in masses to welcome him in his visits, etc. And obviously, increasing authoritarian style of the government. So, again, coming back to similarities between Tajikistan and Turkmenistan and what Tajikistan is going through today, how does it compare to what happened in Turkmenistan in the early 90s. So what kind of striking similarities, Bruce, you see between these two nations?
Well, the one thing is that you no longer have the title of president doesn't have as much meaning because you have some other title that supersedes that. It's much a higher title, and that's what we're already seeing there. You mentioned the fact that now there's all, Rahmon hasn't written, he has written some books, but it's not on the same level as Rukhname by Niyazov. However, there is an abundance of literature coming out about Rahmon and his life, which portrays him, of course, quite favorably. And this also looks a lot like what happened during Niyazov's time, where you had all kinds of stuff, literature that was devoted to him. We know the media coverage in Turkmenistan in Niyazov's day, and still to this day under Berdimukhametov, greatly resembles now what's happening in Tajikistan. Rahmon was always the center of attention on all the news programs. It's even accented more than that. There was the renaming of cities and towns, but specifically renaming a city to be named after the leader. We saw Turkmenbashi City in Turkmenistan, and now apparently we're going to have a little more modest settlement in Gorno-Badakhshan, which is slated to be called Rahmanabad one of these days. So now you have the city named after him. There's also these pointless grandiose projects which the governments engage in, which is supposed to show the glory of the nation somehow or another. Turkmenistan, of course, had a bunch of those. The most absurd example being that revolving golden statue of Niyazi. But, you know, look at Tajikistan with the largest flagpole in the world. It's no longer true now. But, I mean, they have these things that really serve no good purpose for the people. The money would be much better spent on infrastructure and projects like that. And then, of course, along with, you know, what was present in Turkmenistan and we're seeing increasingly in Tajikistan is the growth of sycophants. You know, I mean, there's these people that follow the president, and, you know, and in the case of Tajikistan, it's even worse because he's got the state-sponsored religious people in there, too. So he's got the imams and everyone besides the government officials who are, like, you know, licking his boots and coming and telling the people what a great man this is and how important it is to pay proper respect to him because he's done so much for the country, although it isn't very obvious at first what he's done for the country.
Right. In Turkmenistan, like in Niyazi's era, it was too many of them, like the statues, horses, where you have, like, there was a famous one, looking at sun all the time. And then Berdimuhamedov started doing similar stuff, like, you know, putting out statues, not only himself, but also his extended family members. And we are not seeing yet this trend in Tajikistan. Is there any cultural, political reasons behind that?
No, I think it's all egotism. Otherwise, you know, unless you want to go way back to the pre-Russian era, then yes. It was a habit in the old days, the emirs and Hans. When one emir died or Han died, the first thing you did was change the name that you put in the khutbah and the namaz on Friday, and you started minting coins with the new ruler's name and generally his portrait, if that was possible, too. You could see, you know, it's more elements of medieval Central Asia than it is of contemporary Central Asia.
Steve, coming to you, recently you had a report on Tajikistan, obviously outlining abuse of human rights and political rights. I do not see how it can be compared with the situation in Turkmenistan, and there was not at all any opposition figures or the parties from the beginning in the country. How it can be compared in that perspective, like in terms of repression and crackdown against any potential dissident in the country?
Right. Well, I mean, of course, the situations are different, although in Turkmenistan, we know of approximately 100 cases of enforced disappearances. That's where political prisoners are held by the government, and the Turkmen government refuses to acknowledge that it's holding them in custody. And in many cases, we haven't known for years now if many of these people are alive or dead. So certainly the severity of abuses on many levels in Turkmenistan and Tajikistan is extremely great. But as you said, the recent crackdown, and as Edward said, the recent crackdown is unprecedented. And I would add to what Edward said, it's not only that you have hundreds of people detained and arrested inside Tajikistan, and not only them, but their relatives across the country being put under house arrest, a mass exodus of anyone even perceived to be part of the IRPT or the opposition. And not only them, but their lawyers and the lawyers that represent the lawyers. We now have at least five lawyers, in prison, in detention, in Tajikistan, which is, again, a completely new phenomenon for that country. We also have one journalist in prison in the past year, which I think is the first such case. And beyond that, what is so striking about relatively modest Tajikistan in terms of the weight and the power or the force of its security services is that it's been punching above its own weight abroad and really hunting its opponents in other countries. So one of the interesting features of this crackdown is that many people have been detained in Russia, in Belarus, in Moldova. They've been hunted in Kazakhstan, in Kyrgyzstan, and in Turkey, of course, as we know. One of the most dramatic incidents was the shooting of Umar Ali Kuvatov, the opposition figure from Group 24, in March 2015. And the string of abuses since then has been dramatic. We had one activist named Maksud Ibragimov, who called for democratic reforms in Moscow in 2014, was later stabbed, then kidnapped off the streets of Moscow, and magically reappeared in Dushanbe confessing to crimes and then sentenced to a long prison term of 17 years. And unfortunately, with the trial against the IRPT, which just started on February 9th, it looks like that is not going to be an aberration. So we could actually have dozens of people getting sentences of 17 years, 20 years on what appear to be extremely flimsy, trumped-up cases of so-called extremism.
Right, right. Another big difference between Turkmenistan and Tajikistan is at least I'm trying to come to the president employing of his relatives and brothers and sisters and sons and daughters to high-level positions in the government. Unfortunately, unfortunately, in the previous president's case in Turkmenistan, he was an orphan. But we are seeing similar trends in Turkmenistan these days with a new president. He's also employing some of his relatives. But this become a huge issue lately in Tajikistan, right? I mean, wherever you put your finger, you find someone from Rahman's family. How this rise of personality cult is seen in the day-to-day business of the government?
I think, as you said, Tajikistan is a neo-patrimonial, nepotistic state. And the state itself is effectively distributed between members of the Rahman family or families, prominent families who've married in to the Rahman family. For example, Rahman's brother-in-law controls the largest private bank in the company. His son-in-law is the first deputy chairman of the National Bank and is also the country representative for the EBRD. His son, Rustam Emomali, who has the reputation of a playboy, one-time owner and forward for the FC football club, which won the league back in 2010, I think it was, with no defeats. Subsequently has kind of taken on responsible roles and is now in charge of the anti-corruption agency. His daughter, Ododa, was formerly first deputy Minister of Foreign Affairs and is now deputy or head of the presidential administration. So yeah, he's really, the state infrastructure is heavily infiltrated by members of his family, people who've married into the family. And really to have any position of power in the country, with a few exceptions, such as the mayor of Dushanbe, but the lawyer, you know, you need to have almost these family ties with the regime.
Right. I also would like to call it like Turkmenization of Tajikistan. So how does this Turkmenization of Tajikistan is reflected in day-to-day life of ordinary people, Bruce, in Tajikistan?
Well, more and more, the whole country is centered around, all the activities in the country are centered around the president. I mean, he's omnipresent, you know, and this is a very, very disturbing trend because, of course, in the case of Turkmenistan, what we did have, we had a country that was five different clans. Okay, fine, but it was generally kind of a unified country, and the Turkmen understood that they were all part of the Turkmen, and there wasn't huge divisions between them. Tajikistan's a different country. The north and the south are very different. The east is different, you know. And so, for the idea that we're going to have one leader who seems to embody all the qualities that are needed within Tajikistan, this is very troubling because it's a much more diverse and dynamic country in terms of what's happening inside the country than Turkmenistan was. So that's one of the big problems I see with this whole thing too. And just one other big difference between Turkmenistan and Tajikistan was that, you know, when Turkmenistan, Niyazov, when he started, he was the leader of the country and he was appointed by officials in the Kremlin. So he had some kind of background with leadership that at least in the view of Moscow, led them to conclude that he would be an adequate chief head down there in Turkmenistan when it was still a Soviet republic. Rahman's a totally different person. He was put there essentially by paramilitaries who figured at the time that they would be able to get rid of him after he had served his purpose. He's outlived the paramilitaries in the end, but he wasn't put there for his qualities of leadership by any means at all. Quite the opposite. Yeah, he was put there as someone who would be malleable, easily controlled, and easily dispensed with when his services were concluded. So.
Steve, again, we are comparing Tajikistan and Turkmenistan. In Tajikistan's case, it seems still people are more or less free to live where they like to live, more or less free to exit the country, or people still are able to visit Tajikistan. And it is not the case in Turkmenistan. So still, Tajikistan, it seems, at some points, much better than the situation in Turkmenistan is.
You know, I do think that that Tajikistan, as I was saying, you know, in some realms of civil society, there are NGOs that are able to do independent work.
Yeah.
But going back a little bit to what Bruce was saying, this culture of fear on the ground has been multiplying. So, I mean, in some of the recent trips I've taken to Tajikistan, some of the, in terms of this increasing, maybe creeping Turkmenization that you're talking about, I'll meet with colleagues and, you know, they'll sort of point to the computer and they'll say, oh, well, you know, a few days ago, my Gmail was completely down. And YouTube was blocked. And of course, the Tajik service of Radio Free Europe has been blocked. And there's certainly a sense, earlier there was, of surveillance within civil society. Many journalists have been leaving their jobs, have been leaving the country. So we've certainly seen this crackdown getting worse and worse. And since September, things have sort of gone on hyperdrive in terms of this culture of fear expanding. The discussion of many topics is now taboo, whether it's talking about the IRPT or it's Group 24 or it's freedom of religion. And so, you know, there's a censorship, there's a self-censorship, which is extremely disturbing and sad to see in one of the few places in Central Asia where you did have a strong civil society. In terms of the freedom of movement that you were referring to, we're also seeing a number of people being prevented from leaving the country. As I mentioned, family members and relatives of, for example, not just Muhyiddin Kabiri, the exiled leader of the IRPT, but many other relatives of IRPT members have been prevented en masse from leaving the country. So while you don't have an exit visa system like you do in Uzbekistan or one in Turkmenistan, which is informal, in Tajikistan, you have a certain category and class of citizens that are being prevented from leaving. And then you also have had several incidents of foreigners who have come in trying to research or assist victims of human rights abuses who have been detained, harassed, intimidated. You had a group of Turkish lawyers a few weeks ago that experienced a lot of pressure. So I think, unfortunately, the trends are very negative. And we could see, in fact, it wouldn't be surprising to see further restrictions of visa requirements.
Thank you, Steve. Let's take a short break here. When we come back, we will particularly look into what is causing the ongoing political shift in Tajikistan. Hello, welcome back to the Majlis, Central Asia podcast at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. Today we are talking about Turkmenization of Tajikistan, and I have Edward Liman, a Tajikistan researcher at the University of Exeter, and Steve Sverdlo, human rights researcher in Central Asia, and Bruce Panier, editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Central Asia blog called Kishlag Owazi, with me to discuss the subject. And I'm Mohammed Tahir, director of the Turkmen Service. So it's been interesting to see some of the comparison between Tajikistan and Turkmenistan. Turkmenistan is beyond any doubt one of the most closest country on earth. Why did Rahman decided to take this direction, Edward?
I think it's a difficult question to answer. In terms of the marginalization of the opposition, you know, the information campaign against the Islamic Renaissance Party in particular, you know, started, you know, probably around the time of the death of the former leader, Sayyid Abdullah Nouri, back in 2006, and then became stronger throughout the last 5 years. But as Steve mentioned, you know, since 2015, it's become a kind of unprecedented crackdown. So yeah, it's not. It the situation has certainly become a lot more serious in the past few months.
Why did it happen? Why did it happen? And what caused for Rahman to do what he's doing?
I think it is partly about the fact that he feels that he can do it, and that he is in a strong enough position to do away with the parties like the IRPT, that he feels that, you know, the education system that's kind of brainwashing people into supporting him as the kind of leader of the nation and the originator of peace is sufficient that he can totally marginalize and obliterate the opposition. And I think it's also partly about the fact that countries like the West, Western countries, continue to give support regardless of the human rights situation. You know, the U.S. Announces tens of millions of dollars of counterterrorism training, you know, the next tranche of a long ongoing project just days after, you know, the arrest of all of these IRPT members back in September. So, you know, he's kind of looked at the situation. He's seen that the Chinese and Russians will support him regardless of the human rights situation, and the West will do so also. So, yeah, he feels secure in his position.
Can I just jump in and say I agree completely with that? Mm-hmm. I would second all of Edward's points and say that I think, you know, Rahmon also looks around the neighborhood and he sees that Karimov did the exact same thing, and in some senses Nazarbayev. You know, those are the dictators that got away with it, and Rahmon has been able to watch and learn and study. And so, I mean, in so many senses, you've got Tajikistan moving in that direction. The laws that are incredibly restrictive concerning religious practices that Tajikistan implemented in 2009 and then 2011 in many ways were based on earlier extremely repressive laws passed in Uzbekistan. There's a lot of learning and sharing, and as Edward says, watching of the West's inability or lack of interest to press these concerns. And unfortunately, we saw a recent report coming out of a major think tank in Washington actually proposing that there be no human rights conditions at all on the provision of military assistance. And I think that's the message that Rahmon and others in the region are hearing very loud and clear.
Bruce, you want to talk about this, I stuck with my first question. That is, Rahmon had everything he needed. Like, he's the president, he can reshuffle the cabinet of ministers, remove general from the post, and he does whatever he likes to do. I mean, there was not any particular opposition to that. But why he has to do all this stuff?
Well, certainly the first reason is because his term, his constitutionally legal term limit is about to expire in 2020, so he had to figure out some way to get out of that so that he could stay on after that. Let's remember that all these guys have pulled some interesting moves, I'll say, in their day, and they probably could all be brought to court. I'll just say flat out, they all could be brought to court for crimes they've committed while they've been in government, whether that mostly financial stuff. But anyway, so they've backed themselves into a corner where they almost have to stay in power, because if they step down from being president or leader of the country, they open themselves up to potential lawsuits and imprisonment in the future from a less than sympathetic successor. So what strikes me, though, about the Rahmon case, why now? Why would it happen now? Last year was the 18th anniversary of the Tajik peace deal. So you have a huge segment of the population now who don't remember this war at all. That's what kept the peace, and that's what kept the cooperation between the government and the Islamic Renaissance Party of Tajikistan. No one wanted to go back to the civil war because everyone could remember how that was. Now you're bringing up the next generation. The people that are 18 years old are entering college this year. They don't remember any of this at all. And it's significant that now, you know, what do we have here? This is Avesta, a new lecture course entitled Emomali Rahmon, the Architect of the New State of the Tajik People, has been introduced at some faculties of the National University of Tajikistan. You can get away with that now, because these people that are entering college don't remember anything about the Civil War. And when you get rid of the Islamic Renaissance Party of Tajikistan, again, the young people don't remember what the Civil War was like, and don't remember the early days and the contributions, the very important contributions that the RPT made to the peace process, for one, just by holding the peace for all that time. So he's got a new generation coming up. If he can get them indoctrinated properly, it guarantees that he, possibly his family, stay in. So it might be significant that we passed an 18-year anniversary here.
It doesn't look like that everything will happen the way he is planning, if the intention is that he wants to stay longer than constitutionally he's allowed. Like you are seeing increasing resistance by certain group in the country. Like, you remember last year, there was a high official picking up gun and fighting against the soldiers there. But, you know, is it kind of early signs of another chaos that you mentioned, Bruce?
Well, see, of course, he's running a risk with this. There are, as I said, not everyone has forgot about the Civil War, and that includes people that were fighting against his government. I know Edward's been on the program before. We've mentioned that there are people within the government, too, who were not exactly, they were his allies during the war because it suited their purposes, but they're not really his allies. So he's got some enemies out there in the country. And by pushing this, and especially, you know, and bringing all his family members in and pushing, extending his term limit and stuff, he is running a risk, and things could go very, very badly, very quickly.
And there's another.
Not to mention also some free advertising for extremist groups, you know, that look to, you know, Rahmon's decimation of the IRPT, a moderate Islamist voice, as another objective piece of evidence of a crackdown on Muslims, which, you know, really is just terribly timed in a way to strengthen any voices that are calling for, you know, ISIS or other extremist like groups to gain popularity among Tajiks. It could, as Bruce says, I mean, it backfire, I think, probably more directly in terms of the actual structure of the state, the way Tajikistan is run from inside, but it also has major implications for outside and online.
Steve, you said crackdown and also the backfire it has to society at large. But on the other hand, it is not only the rising personality cult of the president or the crackdown against potential, you know, opponents inside of the country or outside of the country. Now there is another reality, that is the economic situation. Remittances are not coming back and there are lots of frustration among the people. Even if Rahman wants to control the situation, can he control that, Edward?
I think part of the new law not only declared Rahman leader of the nation, but also originator of the peace. And I think, in fact, that second title is maybe more important. As Bruce mentioned, you know, the young generation didn't experience the horrors of the civil war. They've grown up after the peace deal, but they're constantly bombarded with this message that, you know, there was this horrible fratricidal war, is the word that's used in the kind of Tajik state discourse. And, you know, Emom Ali Rahman, the strong president, lifted the country out of the civil war, built a peaceful, democratic, secular country that is stable and prosperous. I mean, so the government narrative goes. And I think that's a very important source of legitimacy for Emom Ali. And as long as people continue to believe it, even if there are economic troubles relating to the fall in remittances, people are still too scared to go back to the war because they associate the government with stability and at least a negative peace with the absence of conflict. So I think although the situation is dire, it's not dire enough for kind of mass mobilization, the kind of mass mobilization we saw in 1992, immediately before the Civil War.
Okay, let's see what Bruce thinks about this.
I just wanted to jump in with one comment that you know, a lot depends on how they're going to spin this as far as the economic crisis. Now, in Turkmenistan, for instance, we've seen they have such media control that although they're willing to concede that the economy is having problems, it's not the fault of Turkmenistan or the Turkmen government that's happening. It's a world crisis. Now, in Tajikistan, if you would have an opposition, and if you would have, they do have some independent media, but if you weren't able to control that really well, people could get the idea out that it was incompetence on the part of the government that had led you to these unfortunate circumstances you now find yourself in. Now that he's been able to crack down on a lot of this stuff, the government is going to be the sole architect of information, so to speak. They're going to be the ones that are going to explain to everyone why they're in this situation, and you can count on the fact that the government is going to have no blame in this at all, and that, like Turkmenistan, they're going to say it's events outside our control, and if it wasn't for the wise policies of our government, it'd be a lot worse than it is.
Steve, last point to you. So what is the best shot of the Tajik government or President Rahman through which he could sustain the relative stability that exists in the country, in Tajikistan today?
Right, right. Just that, I mean, one other observation on that I just want to mention is that I think Rahman is also going to play, in terms of his conversations with international partners, one thing that we hear at Human Rights Watch from some of the diplomats we've been raising the human rights situation with is that they perceive that the economic situation in the country is so dire and that you have, you know, this potential of hundreds of thousands of people returning and standing unemployed on the streets, that they, I think, in some sense are buying the narrative that the government is selling, which is that, look, we have to crack down. Not only do we have existential threats from the south and from without, things like ISIS, but we also have this economic existential threat, and we have to control things or else you're going to have a failed state, and you don't want that. We have enough problems to deal with in this region, and so support us and let us do what we need to do. So I think that economic narrative is also empowering, enabling the Tajik government to carry out these abuses without too much pressure. And I think that calculus definitely needs to change in terms of what Washington says and what Brussels says. We've seen some encouraging signs in the OSCE of critical statements about the situation, but there needs to be more. In terms of, you know, what should the Tajik government do to promote stability in the country, I think the answer is always to live up to its international commitments. It's to actually
ensure that the rights in the Constitution are afforded to its citizens. I think it is the vibrancy of the civil society in Tajikistan. It is the ingenuity, the entrepreneurship of so many Tajiks and business people that could actually make Tajikistan a stable and prosperous place. And you know, those talents actually have to be allowed to flourish. And I don't think it's outside the realm of possibility that could happen. But you would need a sea change in terms of the philosophy of the current government. And you'd need to have some pressure from outside that says that, you know, Tajikistan has to live up to the basic rules of the international system.
Right. Thank you very much, Steve Severtlou, Human Rights Watch Central Asia researcher, for your insightful comments. Also, Edward Lemon, Tajikistan researcher at the University of Exeter. Big thanks goes to you. And also, thank you, Bruce Pioneer, editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Central Asia blog called Kishlak Awazi. Thank you, gentlemen, for being part of the show today.
Thanks. Thank you.
This is it from me, Mohammed Tahir, director of the Turkmen Service at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. Bye-bye.